principles gathered from several amazing resources. And among those were Thomas Jefferson Education and also the Well-Educated Heart. And what I was learning from them was that successful homeschool would have much more to do with my home than my school. And I was also learning from them about an education of the past where students read from classics and rather than textbooks. And I was learning that there were treasures contained in the classics that every human heart yearns to know. I was also learning that rather than be taught by teachers and professors who profess what they know and tell you what you should know, that the children could be guided by mentors who lead and guide, inspire, and draw out through Socratic method of discussion. I was also learning that this was the same type of education that nearly all the great thinkers, leaders, and statesmen throughout history had received. And it was what our founding fathers had received. And that by building a program for teens around original source classics like Plato, Aristotle, and Locke, our children would come to not only encounter the history of the Western culture, but to understand and appreciate the entire progression of Western thought. And that this would help them understand and defend freedom and also teach them how to think. So, needless to say, this was a far cry from anything that I had received in my public school education, right? And I was so excited to try to provide it for my children. I was taught that in the beginning, I should focus on teaching, well, I should focus really on creating an atmosphere of love and beauty and inspiration as the heart of my children's education. And then on top of that, as they were learning good values and you know, getting established in our home and used to family and home routines, on top of that, I could add classics of all kinds, like everything from art, music, literature, poetry, to math, science, and history, and that these things could be learned through the classics. So one of the most intriguing ideas, though, that I encountered during this time was that this education felt good inherently to children and to everyone, and that because it felt good, because it was satisfying, they could be inspired to want to learn it on their own, and that you would not even have to require school of them if you could inspire them to want to pursue it. And this I had to test because that was quite an idea, you know, as a mother to throw out. My daughter was only four. My oldest child was four. I hadn't done any homeschooling or public schooling of any kind. I hadn't done any schoolwork with my kids. And so I didn't have experience with that. But I decided, like, if this is true, I'm going to find out. Because if I could put my efforts into inspiring rather than, like, policing and trying to get kids to learn, how much more fulfilling my role as a mother would be. So there I was, a young mom with a house full of little kids, and I was going to do everything in my power to test this out. I was going to inspire them, I was going to focus on the atmosphere of the home, and I was going to see what would come of it. Could they actually be prepared enough by the time they're 14 or 15 to be able to tackle those great books like Plato, Aristotle, and Locke, or would there be some deficiencies in it? So I put my whole heart into it, and here are some of the things that I tried. Every night, almost every night, we would read classic literature as a family, hoping to inspire them with great ideas in the, you know, the most inspiring hours of the evening, so they would go to bed with those thoughts and stories and ideas in their heads. I also made a habit of reading to them after lunch, hoping to inspire their playtime adventures with great tales and stories and just putting good ideas in their head for that. I often read to myself in front of them to try to teach by example. And I let them see me journaling, and I also read them fun little stories from my journal, hoping that they might see a real life to be writing. And then sometimes I even purposely began little short stories that I was reading to them in front of them on purpose when I knew I didn't have time to finish them, and I would set it down. I just wanted to see, you know, would they go pick it up and start reading it. And alongside of all this inspiring, I really honed in on family life, teaching chores and habits and refining family routines and trying to build self-discipline and values and confidence. I also became extremely sensitive to toys and activities that were overstimulating that might keep them from noticing the subtle beauties in the classics. And let's see, and I really greatly simplified the home in my efforts to do that. And as time went on, with this dual focus of trying to refine my home, build these beautiful family routines, and then also inspiring them all the time, I began to see significant results. So here are some of the things that I saw. My kids were asking me to teach them to read, and as they would learn, some of them would spend long hours of their free time just reading for fun. So that was really encouraging. I thought, okay, this is working. And many of their afternoons were spent acting out stories of history from the books that they had read, and you know, dressing up and putting on these little plays. And I was really impressed. I thought, okay, they're never going to forget these lessons. And again, comparing it to my public school experience, you know, I just remember trying to memorize dry facts for history quizzes and tests. And it was not a part of me. I did not relate to it. It wasn't special. And these kids are out, you know, just doing all kinds of stories from history and also from literature. those of my children who were old enough to write, they seemed to get a kick out of writing in their journals. So that little example and inspiring seemed to be working. And I remember one time I was cleaning up my daughter's notepads, and I found that she had been writing a story in one of them that sounded a lot like the classic literature she was always reading. So I was really impressed because it was quite advanced for a 9-year-old. So I also, they were asking for piano lessons. They enjoyed practicing piano. I was seeing lots of fruit of my labors. They also wanted to learn real-life skills, like crocheting, wood carving, and cooking. And I was, like, purposely trying to inspire these things, you know, see if they'd pick up on them. But one of the most impressive results that I noticed was how alive their senses had become. They would experience joy over beautiful classical music, fun poetry, great stories, and plays. And it didn't take much to thrill them with delight. Well, all around me, I was noticing kids needing, like, ever more increasing stimulation to be able to feel anything. So this was also really encouraging for me. My kids were obviously not associating their learning with mental strain, because to them, learning was a delight. They had never thought of it as a task like vacuuming or scrubbing toilets. So these initial results were so pleasing that I could not say enough in praise of the inspire, not require idea. But over time, as my kids grew older, something changed. And I didn't know what it was. I couldn't put my finger on what I was doing wrong or what was wrong with these ideas. But what had looked really impressive in a 7-year-old was looking deficient in an 11-year-old. And I could see that and I could feel that. The seeds of inspiration that were planted in a 6-year-old without consistent nourishment and follow-through were dwindling in the 10-year-old. And I could just tell that something was really, really wrong. I was very disheartened because I'd had so much success. And I was so excited about how easy this homeschool was going to be, right? So I just thought, like, what could this be? The results had been so stunning. Was I not inspiring enough? Was I not trying hard enough? Was I getting lazy? Were we as their parents not showing an example, you know, of learning and loving learning? And I honestly could not choose any of those as the cause. We were really doing those things the same as we'd always had been doing. So I couldn't put my finger on what it was, but this is what I saw. Kids once excited about math never had a chance to get good at it. So they did not get the satisfaction that comes from solving an equation. There is a satisfaction and a just a reward that we get when we're learning.
Dopamine.
Yep, exactly, dopamine. And they were not getting that. Although they've been initially inspired to want to write, and they did write things for fun, now that they were older and aware of their deficiencies, their confidence began to slip. Before, they were these little 6 and 7 year olds that read and wrote so much. So you know, they got a lot of attention for that, and they felt really confident. But not having that daily follow-up, not having enough infrastructure to facilitate progress, that excitement wore off. The honeymoon phase wore off. And so one thing that I observed was like an overall lack of balance in their development that couldn't have been detected in the beginning because they were so young. But over time, their ages caught up with and even surpassed their educational pursuits. And it was evident that certain ones favored reading at the expense of math and art. And others were into art and music, but didn't want to do math or read. And I wasn't sure if some of these would work themselves out in the end. I was young. I was inexperienced. My oldest was only 11 by this time. But there was one thing I was sure of, that these kids would not be prepared for Plato, Aristotle, and Locke in a few years. And I was also noticing that no other families I knew of who were doing this were actually producing scholars on that level. Historically, many scholars studied those books starting age 14 or 15. And that's not what I was seeing around me. I saw lots of youth super inspired with what their missions in life might be, but really much busier with clubs, choirs, and co-ops than serious study of those dense works. I saw them excited over the founding fathers, but not reading what they read. And again, this was nobody's fault. We were all trying to discover how to apply some obviously great principles of education and not having an example of who to turn to. These things had been dug up from the past and everyone was experimenting. But right at this crucial moment, a friend introduced to me the original homeschooling series, the original writings of Charlotte Mason. Okay, and it's a 6-volume set that I would eventually spend the next 7 years studying, discussing, and practicing, discussing with an online book group of friends who are also reading the same. And we took it really slowly. We wanted to digest every word because we could tell immediately that her guidance and counsel was filling in all the holes. And so we read a chapter a week and discussed for an hour every week. And that's why it took 7 years because it was a 6-volume set. For those of you who've heard about companions to or commentaries on Charlotte Mason or other resources about her, this is not the same thing. While these sources may be helpful, her original works are a comprehensive treasure trove of insight, and through which I soon discovered that she had literally cracked the code of childhood education. And, you know, when I began homeschooling, what we would always say is, oh, there's no how-to manual. Like people say that about parenting, right? There's no how-to manual. You got to jump in with both feet. You got to listen to God, experiment, try your best. You're going to fail. That's true of parenting. And so several of us were kind of applying that to homeschooling. We're like, there's no manual for childhood education. You just got to jump in and try it. We've got these principles, but it's going to look different every home. We just don't know quite how to do it. And of course, it will look different every home. And of course, there's room for variety, you know, and flexibility within some boundaries. But I would say now, there is a homeschool manual. There is a manual on childhood education, and Charlotte Mason wrote it, and it's her original works. But going back to my friend who introduced her to me, she said to me, this, you got to read this. This fills in all the holes and fixes all of our problems. And she could say our problems because we were all having the same problems. We had this wonderful beginning, and then we would have these kids growing up not able to write and do math and these things on the level that was going to prepare them for this great scholar experience. Okay, So this is what she said to me, and she was right. From the day I started implementing her principles, the anxiety over my kids' progress began to decrease. And I very soon began to witness results in all of my children that went far beyond my wildest imagination. The biggest difference I noticed right off the bat with her teachings was that she required lessons. And at first this scared me because I didn't want to lose that magic that had been developed in my home from not requiring. Watching children fall in love with learning and learn for fun was one of the most beautiful things I'd ever witnessed. It warmed my mother heart and it brought tears to the eyes of many who witnessed it. And so I had to ask myself, if I started requiring, would that love of learning disappear? Now, fortunately, I would soon discover that Charlotte Mason's methods of requiring lessons actually preserved the delight and love of learning. And in fact, to my surprise, it enhanced it. So, let's see. Requiring lessons in the way she taught ended up increasing their love of learning, and soon each of them was getting a great education in all of the subjects. So this was so encouraging because it was scary to go through that roller coaster. And I also learned that she did value that precious educational free time that I so adored. And that by requiring lessons, I didn't have to give that up at all. It just happened in the afternoon. And she counseled parents, in fact, to guard that afternoon unstructured free time with their lives and not let it fill up with too much busyness, because that is the other half of the education. That is where they seek out whatever they want. That is where, say, they love piano more than anything, and they have to stop piano at 8:30 and go to Latin, and they have to stop at Latin and go to reading. They can come back in free time and play all day. And so that is where their passions get to guide their education, not the whole education, but the other half of it. And so this was really important information for me. So she was basically teaching me to inspire and require, and that it's not requiring that kills the magic of love of learning. It really is what you are requiring and how that determines it. And she had a very unique method of delivering the lessons to children that kept them coming back, you know, day after day. But it wasn't intuitive to me. It wasn't something I would have thought of. Requiring to me was associated with this boring, rigid, lifeless public school. And I think that was the same for a lot of us. So to think, let's inspire and not require, was like, let's leave the bad behind, let's go do the good. But she had the discernment to see that was not the reason. And she even spoke to the debatable topic in her day. But the thing that turns the kids off to learning is what you're requiring and how. It's not the fact that you're requiring. Requiring means I love you, right? Requiring means this is so serious that you don't get to grow up without it. Kind of like chores. We would no sooner let our kids grow up lazy and irresponsible and never contributing to chores because we're just like inspiring and hoping that they catch on. That's where she placed this of utmost importance, and so it's required. Okay, so let's see. So what I want to do is I want to talk to you about her basic main principles. She has a lot of them. It took 7 years to digest them, but what I can fit in this time, I want to share with you. My daughter and I teach entire courses on this to parents. So if you like what you're hearing and you want to learn more details, you can go to her books, you can contact us. We've got all kinds of resources for you. Okay, let me just, for sake of time, move down a little bit. Okay, I do want to say one more general thing about her before I get into the details. Okay, the educational free time that I loved when the children were learning for fun, that was so magical, that I mentioned was preserved even when we started requiring lessons. What I saw increase in that is as the children got more skill, then they could do even more free time adventures, even more, you know, composing little trios with their violins, even more writing stories, even more reading. So it really, requiring lessons changed everything because it really gave my kids wings to fly. Okay, so what was so unique about her method that made it so successful? Why was she able to require daily structured lessons without putting the children into box checking mode? Right? Because that kills everything. When they think, okay, I got to do da, 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 then I can go play, their brains and hearts turn off. And this is the big mystery. I think that's one of the reasons we're all here. We want to know what turns kids on to learning. We want to know what lights that spark. And so stay tuned. Another question, how did she get them to study subjects they didn't choose without turning them off to learning? That's another thing in the homeschool world that's very common. We will cater an education around their passions. So we're like, well, we want that passion. Look how they study. If they're studying airplanes, they love airplanes. Look how they study when they're doing music. This is a musical prodigy, so I got to cater to that. But Charlotte Mason warned against that. She said, that's how you raise eccentric children. Everyone needs the basics. The child who hates classical music needs it more than any of the other children who like it. The child who is less inclined toward math needs it for his personal development. Okay, and then really, in other words, the big question was, how did she turn out real scholars that write college-level essays and understand trigonometry without ever compromising the magic of childhood? That's what we all wanted. That's what my friends and family and I all wanted. We wanted the good stuff. We wanted the education of Thomas Jefferson and Winston Churchill. We didn't want to crush the magic of childhood. All right, so here's how she did it, and I've asked Grace if she would. This is my daughter, Grace. She's going to speak in just a moment at the end of my talk. That's if she would put a couple bullet points up on here. Okay, so.
I'm left-handed, so bear with me. I'm right on a board.
Okay, so, yeah, your sloppy handwriting is going to be, like, better than all of our best. She writes like a font. Beautiful handwriting. Okay, so, first principle, require and inspire. Okay, so we've basically talked a little about that already, but the urge to stop requiring lessons and only inspire them is really understandable because we often, as parents, notice that kids are distracted, tuned out, and unmotivated by schoolwork, right? Does that sound slightly familiar? And that they, when they have to do things that they have to do, compared to how they respond when they do things that they want to do. So logically, it felt like that would fix it, right? Okay, let me skip down a bit because I think I talked about that a little bit. Okay. Now, when the tasks that are that you're requiring actually nourish, fulfill, and give back, it doesn't matter if they are required. You can't turn the children away if it feels good. And so it takes root inside of them, okay? And then that grows and grows and grows till it becomes a part of them, and they own it as they own anything dear to them. They don't even think it came from you. They think, this is my special stuff. And one fun example of this, one of my daughters, when she was 16, Christmas break was coming up, and she was deep into her scholar program with her mentor. They were reading from the great books, The Western World. Grace will talk more about the details of what that scholar program was like. But she came to me whining, and she said, do I have to stop my studies for Christmas break? And I said, of course you do. We're going to make gingerbread. We're going to go caroling. You got to stop all that. And she, you have to know, like, she was social butterfly. Like, she was all plugged in at the high school, going to seminary, being in choir, being in the play, doing all her studies at home in the morning. And she had a lot of friends and plenty of crushes. And, like, her world was all just really fun princess world, right? And she came whining, do I have to stop my scholar studies for Christmas break? She said, could we just ask? And I said, plus she wants to be with his family. And she's like, could I just ask him for a shorter version? At least we meet like a couple times a week. She didn't want to go without that. Why? because it was feeding her. And that's what's so cool, because it's true, because it really feels good, because every human heart does yearn to know these things. We don't have to sell it. We don't have to wear ourselves out trying to make it go. We just need to land on how it's done. And that's where Charlotte Mason comes in. Okay, so let's see. Okay, second principle I want to mention of hers, keep the free time free. So Charlotte Mason taught, like I mentioned, that the morning hours would be this concentrated study time where it is required. It is structured. It is on a schedule. The kids know it's expected, and there's follow through. They really need to do it. But the afternoon was to be free. Now, if someone is choosing, oh, I really want to do Taekwondo, that's free. Like, you can let them go do that. That's still free. They chose it, right? By leave the free time free, I don't mean they can't go do, like, they can't go schedule their free time and make it really booked and busy. I just mean it's not coming from you. If they want to play on the tramp, if they want to hang out with friends, if they want to go sign up for dance, all that's free if they thought of it. Within the bounds of what you approve of in your home, of course. Okay, and she talked about this as being the best part of their education, but that it absolutely depended on the morning half. If the morning stuff was required, they would be equipped with what they needed to thrive and have a glorious free time, to fall in love with learning, pursue what they wanted. So these two things, although quite opposite, had to always be there. The two sides of the coin had to always be there. The one enhances the other. Having that free time to be yourself, to do what you want, whether you're feeling like cooking, whether you're feeling like hanging out with friends, that was so, so important. And that gave them the rest, the break, the inspiration needed to wake up and do all the hard stuff again the next morning. And then, of course, the hard stuff then gave them wings to fly in the afternoon. So these two things went together really nicely. Okay, third principle was she said that we can think of education as the science of relations. Okay, and you can write like form a relation. Yeah, you got it. She wanted the children to be able to form a relationship with whatever it was they were learning. So in order for a child to learn something in a meaningful and lasting way, they must form a relationship with that thing. They must come to know that thing. It's not enough to simply know who Monet was and maybe the names of a couple of his paintings. No, they need to know the paintings, meaning they need to stare at them long enough that the message he was trying to convey through his art sinks into their heart. Albeit subtly and subconsciously, that's what they need to get out of it. They need to know it. It's not enough to simply know, you know, to know who someone was, but to know their work and what motivated them and how it changed the lives of those involved, to have that work touch and move them so that they're moved. This movement is education. Because it's growth, because it's expansion, and it's a drawing out and developing of the divinity inside the child. Okay, just as the word education comes from the Latin root word educare, meaning literally to draw out, not to cram in with a bunch of lessons and information, to draw out. That's the word that education comes from. And it is this drawing out that allows us to connect with and thus form a relationship with the ideas contained in the classics. And it's in this way that they become a part of us and we never forget them. So we don't need to drill, review, test, and quiz. We need to really get the classics through us. And then you don't forget them. When you form a relationship with someone, you don't use memory bank to remember them. You know them. Think of the people that you knew and loved growing up. Now, suppose instead of getting to know them, you had just been given a paper and you had to memorize their names and date of birth and their favorite hobbies and things to do. You would always and forevermore have to go into your memory bank to remember those things. But no, when you spend time with people, when they become a part of you and you become a part of them, it's another part of the brain, right? And it's a part of the heart. And you don't have to use a bunch of effort to try to keep it. That's what we want to happen with the classics. We want them, Oliver DeMille used to say, you're not getting through the classics, you're getting the classics through you. And that's what happens when we use Charlotte Mason style lessons. Okay. So the good news, to form a relationship with the things the kids are learning does not take a bunch of creative lesson planning from us, because the classics do it automatically for us, okay? Because for children, the classics are stories, and stories lead them along, keeping their interest piqued much more than topics do. Children relate to the stories of the people, and once their heartstrings wrap around the person and the situation they were in and what they did, only then does their brain care to know the details. When did this happen? Why did it happen? How can we avoid this in our day? Those are the things we wish they would care about. It all starts with stories. They've been magically put together by experts who were born to do this. And with the click of a button and a couple of dollars, we can have a classic on our doorstep almost overnight, right? And that's a lot simpler than all the lesson planning that a lot of homeschoolers put their time into. I want to give you a quick example of this. Cares, then the brain steps up to the plate and wants to know all the details. So the last few years, not this year, but the past 3 years before this year, I have spent time teaching in some private schools and curious if I could bring these beautiful Charlotte Mason methods to larger groups, because we always did it one-on-one and she counseled to do it one-on-one for almost all the subjects. But I was just curious, you know, it'd be cheaper if we could do this, and there were some really high quality private schools in the town where I live. And so I taught at two different ones of those. And a few years ago, when I was teaching 10, 11, and 12-year-olds, we were reading a couple of historical fiction books, which I highly recommend. One of them, and these are from World War II time, one of them is called The Winged Watchman, and one of them is called Number of the Stars. And these kids had their hearts wrapped around the characters. They knew, they felt for them. They were hurting and sad and upset when the little girls who were harboring their Jewish friend, her family was harboring their Jewish friend while the parents escaped to go seek safety in another land or something. But they're harboring this Jewish friend, and one night they have to bring a lunch to somebody who's going to take her across the river because it's not safe where they are. And they're worried that she's going to get found out. So in the night, this uncle or someone is taking them across the river, and their job is to run through this forest and deliver the lunch with some important papers in the lunch that they needed. And in that experience, the Nazi soldiers stop them. They are abusive. They're rude. They take the lunch out and feed it to their dogs. And these kids in the classroom were just enraged. And then all the questions started coming out. Why did that happen? Who allowed this to happen? How did Hitler even take power? A question after question after question. It was perfect. I had to keep calming them down. It was getting so loud I thought someone was going to come in and see what was going on, because there was yelling. But what I want to say is that was education, because movement was happening. And then all this juice goes to their brain, right? Okay, now we're ready for timelines and dates and we want to understand government and everything now. Okay, so how to use classics instead of workbooks and lessons? It's very simple. Charlotte Mason just said that the children should be reading, depending on age, you know, reading from one to three different classics a day, and every day a different set. Okay, so let's just take an average of two. Two books on Monday, two different books on Tuesday, two different subjects on Wednesday. So, you know, in our family, it was like Monday was scriptures and family history. Tuesday was history and biographies. Wednesday was natural science and physical science. Thursday was literature and geography, and so on and so on. But there are classics in all these subjects. So she really used classics in place of all lessons and workbooks, except for the little skills, the skills you need to develop to be able to dive into the classics, right? They had actual lessons for reading, actual lessons for writing, actual lessons for learning the language of math, actual lessons for learning the language of Latin, and spoken languages. Every time it's a new language, you gotta go through the drills. You gotta sit and memorize and learn and get that language down. But because those tasks are mentally strenuous, she kept them very, very short. I'm talking like 5 to 10 minutes for a child's reading lesson. 5 minutes for their writing lesson, less when they're little and just starting out, 3 to 5 minutes, and that's it. Really, really short, because she wanted them to avoid mental strain. So learning all these languages is short, sweet, right to the point, and then the big bulk of their morning education is simply reading from and writing narrations on those subjects that I just mentioned. That's how she replaced all the workbooks, all the manuals, all the lesson planning. That's how she promoted mothers back to the level of mothers, nurturers, and queens. She said, like, no more sacrificing yourselves on the altar of education. Like, there are better things to do. Use your planning to plan out the schedule for the kids. Plan out how you're going to follow through when they want to be irresponsible. Plan out the menu rotations. You have these beautiful meals and the kids want to live there, right? Plan out beautiful libraries. Put your genius into that, because the great minds have already, the great geniuses who wrote these classics, they already planned the lessons. And what's really cool, they embedded those lessons subtly into beautiful stories so that the naked eye cannot even detect the lesson, but it's going in to the children. And that's the way it should be, because then the children feel like the detectives, the discoverers. They feel like they are gaining this for themselves. And as soon as you just turn the table a tiny bit and say, I've compiled the basics that we need to know about the planets, and I'm going to tell it to you, everything changes. They need to be on the path of discovery. They don't know that they're getting lessons. You couldn't convince a child who just read this little children's biography I'm reading right now on the life of Johannes Kepler. You couldn't convince them that their understanding of the Copernican theory of the rotation of the planets was a science lesson. They just think that they're reading a story. And this, of course, is that like magical, lofty thing we all were trying when we said inspire, not require. Like, oh, let's just read books. Let's just read classics and get this in us rather than all this rigid stuff. But the problem is they need it to be required. They need to know at 10 o'clock I read my first reading and write my narration. At 10:30 I do my other. At 11 I meet with my wife. We talk about my narration. She helps me see my errors in my commas and periods. Like, they need to know what time is piano practice. They need to know what time they're vacuuming. They are not to order their own lives, Charlotte Mason said. And if you will take control as the role, you know, if the role of the educator is to order those things, then you can free yourself up from all of the herding of cattle that it's easy to get into in our homes trying to make kids learn. You take control of the order, the peace, the schedule, and get those books in order on the bookshelves. Get them in order on the spreadsheet. Get them on their schedule, and then they, thinking they're out discovering great things, just like when they dig up worms in the backyard, then they plow through the books. They come tell you all that they remember from it. You rejoice over their written narration, and then you wake up and do it again the next day.
Okay, I have a question.
Okay.
When your kids are more in the scholar phase, is it more they start telling you how their schedule looks, or do you still kind of pattern their schedule the way they...
If they can do it to standard, awesome.
My Caleb would do better him telling me how he was...
Yeah, as kids grow, I'm mostly talking about children here.
Okay.
Grace is going to hit scholar phase, but yeah, as kids grow, they definitely can start owning that. It just depends. There are some kids who naturally do it, and some who are like, I'll just be with my guitar, you know. Yeah. Okay, so let's see. Okay. Let's see, I just want to skip a bit. I'm running out of time. Okay, avoid mental strenuous tasks. Okay, fifth principle. We need to help kids develop a habit of attention. So dumping large loads on them, that's not happening. right? They're going to be overwhelmed. They're going to tune out and turn off. But if they can give 3 minutes when they're six to their reading lesson and 2.5 minutes to their writing lesson and then go play, that is doing well at something small. And that's how children flow. Do well at something small. In a couple of weeks, that could increase. She only ever increases it to 5 or 10 minutes, those lessons. But what happens is they give full attention to something hard. It's harder to memorize your Latin declensions than it is to read Little House on the Prairie, right? So that's like the push-ups. They're strengthening their self-discipline muscle as they do their reading and writing in Latin. They're strengthening it. Then when they're old enough, around 8, she has you start assigning them these readings as soon as they can read independently. Then they've got this strength that they can pour into it. So we're always constantly in chores, in family routines, in, you know, the self-discipline takes to go to bed and be quiet and not poke your brother in the arm, and in studies, constantly helping train them in habits of attention. And then when they need it, they've got that. Okay, one more bullet point. Keeping the writing assignments for children unscripted. So when they do this reading, they are to come tell you, this is an oral narration at first, I'll tell you. They are to come tell you what they read, everything they remember, every detail. And you are to rejoice in it. It's not a time to be quizzical. It's not a time to correct them. You may ask questions out of real interest and intrigue, and that fuels them and excites them for their next reading. That's how it's done. When they've done this for a couple of years and their copy works up to par, I don't have time in this to explain all the details of how she has a magical way of teaching every single lesson. But when they've been orally narrating for a couple of years, they're good at it, they're thorough, they're comfortable, and their copy work is up to par, then you switch to written narrations. And you do have this little interview in the day where you go over and help them. Oh, here's where the semicolon comes in. This word's spelled wrong. Let's write it 5 times. You sneak in 2 minutes this little secret grammar lesson, and they don't have to feel like they want to kill themselves, which is how kids feel in grammar lessons, right? I know, because I taught language arts for 3 years. So anyway, what I want to say about this is, even though you are being specific with the grammar and the punctuation and the spelling, in those few minutes where you require their attention, the main bulk of their writing, where they're writing what they learned from the book, what happened, what they cared about, that is not scripted. And that one detail of staying out of telling them what to write about, throw away the writing prompts that came along with your classic, just get rid of all of it. That one element of it coming from them changes everything. That's what makes them, again, think that it was theirs. That's what brings in the passion. That is the most important thing she brought to the table, is that if they can have their curiosity piqued, their intrigue and their discovery at the height of everything they're doing, right at the forefront as they do it, then you can require lessons. You can stop planning what you're going to teach them the next day, because Mark Twain already did it, right? It's already been done. Okay, so I want to pause here, turn the time over to my daughter, Grace, and she's going to talk to you a little bit about what her scholar program was like. Because since I was so busy researching and learning to change our lives, I was not prepared to be her mentor. So we hired someone who had a bachelor's, master's, and doctorate in the classics. And he would meet with our kids on Zoom and go through the great books of the Western world. And so she's going to talk to you about what that was like. And then if you want to learn more about this, our table is right at the entrance where you registered. And we have all kinds of courses like that. She now teaches youth those same courses that she was taught. And I'm a private math tutor, and so is my other daughter. We teach classical and modern math. And anyway, if you want to learn more, come talk to us. But I want to turn the time over to Grace to tell you what this scholar program was like for her. Okay, yes, I'm going to talk about what exactly this scholar experience was like. And also my thoughts as an adult on the importance of this kind of scholar education and a rigorous classics education in general. So, lasted for 4 years. I think you already touched on this. Basically, my 4 years, ages 14 to 18, and we usually met most summers, so year-round, pretty much. And yes, I would meet with this mentor that my mom was describing one-on-one for about an hour to an hour and a half each discussion, and we met every school day, which for us was 4 days a week most of the time. Sometimes there were a couple of semesters we did 3 days a week, and that worked, though more was definitely better. We used the Great Books of the Western World collection, like she was saying, as the foundation. And many of you probably already know what this set of books is, but if you don't, it's what'd you say?
I don't.
You don't. Okay. It's a 54-volume collection that just covers the most influential works in Western thought, you know, spanning philosophy, literature, civics, history, science, mathematics, going all the way from early thinkers like Plato, Aristotle, Homer, up through time, you know, covering the Romans, the medieval era, Renaissance, Reformation, Enlightenment, modern time, all the way up through major thinkers into the early 20th century. So fitting in this many books took a lot of time. We read not every single word in all of the volumes, but at least some from every volume and most of each volume. So a lot of reading and a lot of writing that accompanied it. Note-taking, analysis, writing essays every week, sometimes a couple a week. And this was being done alongside a few other studies that continued on from earlier, like instruments, Latin and Greek, modern math, and classical math is contained within the Great Books, but modern math, Latin, instruments, I think nature study. So a couple of hours of other assignments alongside this hour to an hour and a half of meeting for discussion, and then about 3 hours I would spend a day on this reading and writing. And I think it was Emily that asked the question, did we set our own schedule? So we were very used to having this scheduled morning where you get everything done and then your afternoon is free. And so I think we had some input into arranging when things would happen, but I think we both just took it for granted that we're going to come up with a schedule that works with the other siblings, so I'm not trying to practice piano when they are, and everybody can use a computer when their time comes up. Right, so we had some say, but we worked together. Okay, talking about the approach we took to reading these. So the Great Books of the Western World are arranged chronologically, like I said, beginning with the earliest thinkers, going into the early 20th century. And we read them like that. So instead of reading, like we did when we were younger, like a science book, a history book, a philosophy, well, I guess you wouldn't do philosophy when you're younger, but instead of reading from different subjects, we would just read a few books at the same time, maybe three or four, and they could be from any subjects. Usually we'd have a philosophy, a history, a science, you know, maybe a literature and a math. We'd pick a handful to have going at the same time, but So instead of dividing the works into subjects, we just read from a few different authors from the similar time period. And I really, really like this approach for reading the Great Books because I think it helps you see how ideas evolve and interact across time. It helps you understand the history of ideas and how they're all interconnected, how each idea influences the other, right? How the philosophy and history of the time is going to be influencing the science, how the science is going to be influencing the culture, how it all works together. And you start to be able to develop this picture of history and this picture of, you know, our civilization and how it's developed for the last few thousand years. And I think that's really, really cool to be able to do as a teenager, and a great addition to, or a great ending for an education. Some themes, I just want to give you some examples of discussion topics that either we'd discuss in class or, you know, themes that I would be writing on or thinking about doing this kind of scholar studies. So a few examples of themes I came up with would be, say, the roots of democracy from ancient Greece to modern America, or natural rights and the Constitution, right? The idea that individuals possess rights, right? Inalienable rights to life, liberty, and property. These ideas trace back to Greek and Roman thought on some of these subjects, and they've been very influential in our own country. The rise of capitalism and free markets is another one. Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, that's in the Great Books. We would read that and understand how it laid the groundwork for capitalism and our understanding of the free market. The ethics of war and just war theory. Thinkers like Augustine or St. Thomas Aquinas developed theories on just war. And honestly, this still provides the framework for the morality of war and the ethical limits of state power today. Debates on utopian societies. These discussions, I think, remain especially relevant, especially as modern movements grapple with balancing social reform and individual rights without tipping over into totalitarianism. The limits of human power and hubris, pride, the dangers of human pride, whether in personal ambition or revolutionary zeal, the need for humility and prudence in discussions of governance and leadership, and especially technology. Anyway, those are just a few examples of things we'd be talking about, writing about. And I think understanding the progression of these ideas and how they all work together really provides clarity about why we think the way we do today and gives you context for being able to enter into any of the relevant debates that we are having today. 5 minutes, okay. I'll have to hurry up a little bit then. That's okay. So how I felt about my experience, I absolutely loved this. I absolutely loved it. The story you gave was of my sister, but I felt the same way. I never wanted to stop. It was so fulfilling and so fun. And I was excited to have someone help me understand these books. I remember being little and like reading children's literature, like Anne of Green Gables or something, and I'd hear someone like Milton or Aquinas mentioned, and I'd want to go to the shelf and pull off that volume and just see if I could read it and be so curious, and then realize, oh, it's way too dense. I can understand the words, but put together, I have no idea what they mean. And I was excited. I was very excited to be able to do that. I knew how important those ideas were, and I wanted to be able to understand them for myself. But I cannot emphasize this enough. Besides all of that inspiration that made me excited, I would not have been able to study like that for hours a day, works that dense, and actually comprehend them without feeling so overwhelmed if that foundation hadn't been laid already of getting things done and also feeling like the great books really weren't that hard because we had worked up to them. I and my siblings who had this similar kind of education, when we've talked about it, we always say, like, yeah, it was never that difficult. It really wasn't that different from the reading we were doing before. And really, we had kind of bridged that gap, plank by plank, book by book, like you say, from Little House on the Prairie to Shakespeare. And so I just want to emphasize again how important I think that was. The careful, gradual methods that my mom has been describing prepared us without even really realizing it, I think, for being able to handle these kinds of studies. Yeah, the idea that this kind of sustained attention should not just be willpower. It should be easy. It should be easy. Okay, I have 3 minutes. Couple of ideas why I think this kind of mentoring, one-on-one mentoring, is really, really good for teens. I do it now, and I love it. I teach, and I loved it at that age. The ideas they're encountering, either in these books they're reading or just in the real world, are heftier. And narrations, just reporting on the facts, sometimes just aren't going to cut it anymore. They need this thorough, rigorous discussion. Also, sometimes it can be helpful to have someone new doing these discussions with a teen, just because at that age, you know, you go to talk about an idea and really maybe you're just talking about the relationship in general and just bringing up everything else that's the resentment. Yeah, between like a parent and child. I remember being that age and I've seen it. But having someone new sometimes can allow them to really just focus on the idea. Someone who stands for the parents' values but isn't in charge of them in any other areas of their life. let's see, yeah, adolescence is a time of questioning and identity formation, and the kinds of questions that the classics address might be just as much about voting for political candidates as they are navigating social groups as a teen. They just remain incredibly relevant for teenagers. They address the big questions that teens care about. What is freedom? What is justice? What makes a great leader? What causes the downfall of a great leader? They speak to teens' desires for authenticity. They don't sugarcoat human struggles. They confront them head on. And teens care about the future. And I think they know society's rise and fall. Those who have had a statesmanship education and know how to think get to influence and become leaders in the next generation. And I think teens care about that a lot as well. Okay, since I have probably 30 seconds left, I just want to tell you quickly why I think this great book's classical education is so important, especially for modern times. I'm sure all of you already know this or think this, but I'm going to add my thoughts. I think they provide the context for understanding today's debates. They give you the understanding necessary to actually engage with them productively. They also immunize us against intellectual fads by grounding us in universal truths that transcend time. Classics teach us to distinguish between the arrogance of the intellect and the application of reason in the pursuit of truth. We live in the information age. There are facts to prove just about anything that you want. But the classics give us understanding of the deepest truths, which never change. And the great books serve as cautionary tales, warnings about bad ideas. And by studying these works, I think we start to recognize recurring patterns in history and society that we can identify and use to better navigate our present challenges. So thank you. That's all.
And we are V. Everything we are full time RV. I am taught by MRI. And
So it won't be then we exactly
So anyway, at the beginning of the year, I thought, I have one son on a mission, my next one is 16.
I'm so glad for you guys to be
a leader.
I think
I called, but you're full. And so there was one that has to be available.
I'm going to come to you. I'm going to come to you. All right.
Oh,
I'm sorry. But
it's on the call of the website, but I'll get it to you now.
Yeah, okay, I'll take it. And then I just thought, like, the other day.
And we will find more mentors. We just haven't been full yet. As soon as we were full, our plan was to hire more. So my youngest daughter just started, and she's full now too.
Yeah.
But we will find more. Like, we'll find more. If you want lessons, we'll find somebody. And we're gonna vet them out really carefully because we care so much about it.
Yeah. A while. I think, like, with my one son that's 16, this is my daughter, Ava.
Hi. Hey.
This is Annie Miller. She's her daughter. So anyway, one thing that I noticed, my one son, he loves to read. He does everything he can get his hands on. Like, he'll just read. And some things to read two or three times because our library, like, you know. But what happened is he kind of developed his love for history. So my husband just started studying history because then he could just talk to him about history. And just talk about history because they've both been studying it and they both have
Well, then get a different.
And it's just like you said, that mentor is someone who can bring new things to the table that you don't necessarily. Like, you need somebody. And it would be, like, the ideal would be for me, like, you guys that are trained and have that experience. But if you don't have, like, an option to that, I would like, well, maybe I could tell my husband, maybe you should start with this collection or whatever, and just kind of start reading.
And just discuss with him.
But I'm just wondering, like, for people, because finances, like, and we just, you know, how much it is, and we believe education is worth all the money, but what would you say for people that are, like, my husband's a piano music teacher, he actually teaches them, but finances are, you know, pretty stretched.
Yeah.
So, in the meantime, before we, you know, like, you can try money. Thank you.